Paul of the past presidents of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary will provoke at least among Southern Baptists the comment, in those days there were giants in the land. The first president, James P. Boyce, scholarly, cultured, wealthy Charlestonian, fought the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary into existence and three times wrought it into life. On July 30, 1856, Professor Boyce, then completing his first session as theological professor at Furman University, delivered his inaugural address entitled, Three Changes in Theological Institutions. In this address, Dr. Boyce set forth the plans which found fruition in this seminary. Upon him later was placed the responsibility for raising the funds to begin the seminary in Greenville, South Carolina in 1859. I cannot help but comment at that point that in our trustee meeting this afternoon, everyone who made a motion was promptly appointed a member of a committee. Again, Dr. Boyce rebuilt the seminary out of the debris of the Civil War. Finally, he carried it on his own shoulders to a firm foundation in Louisville, Kentucky in 1877. Once when addressing the Southern Baptist Convention, he said, I have begged for this seminary as I would not beg for myself if I were starving. To this his biographer adds, and his proud face proved it true. In the biography of Boyce is this sentence. His sister relates that he once made an appeal in the Citadel Square Church of Charleston until she sat and wept to hear him beg so hard. Such pleading was necessary. There was no other source of support. This seminary has a unique place among the Southern Baptist agencies, beginning really as the third of our Southern Baptist agencies, the first two, the Foreign Mission Board and Board of Domestic or Home Mission Board. The seminary grew up alongside of the convention rather than inside of it. Its roots are in Baptist individualism rather than Baptist organization. It rose not on the shoulders of the denomination, but on the personal sacrifices of individual donors. The second president, John A. Broaddus, was one of the original faculty of four. In the critical days of the early summer of 1865, the four professors met in Greenville, South Carolina, quote, to consult as to the possibility of keeping the seminary alive and beginning operations in October. The seminary had begun in 1859 without buildings, but with a good endowment in hand or pledged. Alas, the pledges were paid in Confederate money, and most of the endowment was invested in Confederate bonds. Sharing in the defeat of the South, the seminary's assets also were gone with the wind. All that was left to the seminary was $5,000 par value of Georgia Railroad bonds, actually sold for $3,878. You'd expect me to note that sort of thing under these circumstances. Some unsaleable land in Greenville, South Carolina, and the seminary had one thing more. The devotion of the faculty to a divinely given task. After long discussion of the difficulty of reopening the seminary and frequent prayers for guidance, Dr. Broaddus said, suppose we quietly agree that the seminary may die, but that we'll die first. Like thunder from distant hills, that sentence rolls down the years to warn all who identify themselves with this school that it demands an allegiance which may cost life itself. Southern Baptists today perchance will not object if they be reminded that those who give their money for the continuation of this school own it no more than, but alongside of those who in the past have continued it with their lives. The price of our heritage can never be a mess of pottage. Let us quietly agree that we will starve before we betray our trust. A trust from Baptists who kept faith with their convictions instead of asking what was expedient. William H. Whitsitt served as a member of the seminary faculty for 23 years. In the strange fashion to which we in religious groups are sometimes occasioned, for those years he was an Orthodox Baptist. According to one reporter of the events, when he thwarted the ambitions of some who aspired to the presidency of the seminary by being elected to the position himself, he immediately became the target of charges of heresy. His opponents insisted on determining what happened in England in 1641 by a vote of various Baptist bodies convened in 1897. Whether Whitsitt was right or wrong, the issue was historical and not doctrinal. After 4 years as president, Dr. Whitsitt resigned because he could neither deny what he believed to be an historical fact, nor bear to blight the seminary by what had begun, at least, as a personal feud. The important legacy from the Whitsitt controversy to the seminary was the action of the trustees. While accepting his resignation, they expressly reaffirmed their adherence to the principle of freedom of research and refused to set up any new standards of orthodoxy. Said Dr. Whitsitt in his farewell address on June 1, 1899, "I desire to present a parting request. I beg them one and all to be always and everywhere Orthodox, earnest Baptist, to stand fast in the ancient tenets of our denomination." Strange words from a man charged with heresy. Thus his example and words set our basic Baptist convictions and freedom at the very center of the life of this school. In the footsteps of Boyce, it fell to E.Y. Mullins both to build a faculty, to build a new campus, and to build a seminary into the hearts of Southern Baptists. When Mullins became president in 1899, John R. Sampe, then aged 35, was the senior member of the faculty. At its beginning, 40 years before that, the oldest member of the faculty was William Williams, aged 38. Basil Manley, Jr. was aged 33. Boyce and Broadus were 32. You can see quite obviously why I have looked up and taken note of those. I note with encouragement these figures because today I am younger than the oldest member of the faculty in 1859 and older than the oldest member of the faculty in 1899. The growth of Louisville made President Mullins decide to move the seminary from Broadway and Fifth to this present site. Mullins is described as scholar, administrator, Christian statesman, world citizen, servant of God. But all of these came to focus upon the life of the seminary. In his own personality, he bound the seminary to the organized Baptist life of the world. He served as president of the Southern Baptist Convention from 1921 to 1924, and as president of the Baptist World Alliance, 1923 to 1928. When his wife remonstrated with him over the acceptance of so many responsibilities, he would smile and say, It advertises the seminary. That, she wrote, was reason enough for doing things of all sort, and it was true that his constant activity kept the seminary before the people. Under the leading of Dr. Mullins, the charter of the seminary was amended to provide stronger legal ties to the denomination. Whereas under Dr. Whitsitt, the seminary fought for and won the right of freedom of research, under Dr. Mullins, the seminary gladly identified its life with that of the denomination. President John R. Sampi, like his beloved Robert E. Lee, had the mantle of his greatest responsibility placed upon him in the face of almost impossible odds. He was elected president just before the financial crash of 1929. $1 million mortgage on the seminary added to his burden. His presidency just barely overlapped the depression of the 1930s. Dr. Sampi's administrative creed was summed up in these words. When it was apparent that drastic reduction must be made, I resolved to protect the faculty from any heavy cuts in salary that would cripple them in their work. A school, he said, must have teachers and pupils. It can function with a greatly reduced administrative staff. I remember those words. It is difficult for me to speak of Dr. Sampi and Dr. Fuller without digressing to say many other things that occur to me. There was a time when I was Dr. Sampi's student, Dr. Sampi's employee, as I tried to serve the seminary, and at the same moment, Dr. Sampi's pastor. There is still a rumor extant in the Broadway Baptist Church of this city that there was a deacon's meeting the night before my doctor's examination in which it was agreed that if I failed to pass, there would be one less member of the church on the next day, and I passed. Actually, you'll allow this. I wear tonight the gown of Dr. John R. Sampi, which in turn was passed on by him to Dr. Ellis Adams Fuller and handed to me by Mrs. Fuller. President Ellis A. Fuller was the man of the hour. Brief though it was, the hour of his presidency yet spanned a period of transition and opportunity. It was transition from depression to inflation. It was transition from debt to generous denominational support. It was a transition from a small faculty to perhaps the largest faculty in any Baptist seminary in the world. It was a transition from vacant rooms in Mullins Hall to two students in each room. Much of the building on the campus today and most of the faculty present here indicate how President Fuller used the opportunity. I once recorded a long-distance telephone conversation with him in which he said this: a demagogue may someday mislead some session of the Southern Baptist Convention, but the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary will serve as a gyroscope to bring it back to the middle of the channel. I am determined, he said, to build a faculty and a campus which will stand firm in any form of doctrinal controversy or financial disaster. I kept those words because they intrigued me. The conception of the seminary as belonging to the life of the denomination, but not as being bolted fast to its institutional structure. For a denominational seminary, that is a lonely course. But it is the only course of leadership. It equates the right and responsibility of the seminary to provide leadership as being alongside that of any other part of the denomination's institutional life. It claims for the seminary the same right to speak on the issues of the day as may be possessed by any other denominationally elected or self-appointed group. In fairness to my predecessors, I must point out that the aspects of their administration upon which I have seized would not necessarily be those they would claim as their contribution. What makes these quotations and comments pertinent to this occasion is that they provide the setting for my own administration. And I am talking to you, whether you have recognized it or not, about the seminary and the denomination. That is true if for no other reason than the fact that these interpretations dominate my thinking in defining the relationship between the seminary and the denomination, a relationship which has been hammered out on the anvil of the years. With respect to the denomination, the function of a seminary is first to provide a trained ministry for the churches. Second, it is to provide through its faculty and alumni men who are capable of giving leadership in the various areas of the life and thought of the denomination. Third, it is to provide a consistently corrective influence upon the beliefs and programs of the denomination by calling for a re-examination of them in the light of the Word of God. Let me enlarge upon these three statements. The basic function of a denominational seminary is to provide a trained ministry for the churches of the denomination. This involves both the distinctive methods and the unique message of the denomination. When the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary was launched, it was a unique institution. To use the phrase of Dr. Broadus, it was a common theological school. Its classes were equally open to the college graduate and the man without previous academic preparation, because Baptists were that kind of people. Its classes were open, but its own academic integrity was safeguarded by making the completion of the course as difficult as entrance was easy. Through the years, there has never been any quarrel among Southern Baptists with the thesis of Dr. Boyce in that address in 1856, that a theological school should make its facilities available to all who would prepare for the ministry. There has, however, been a gradual change which has been much accelerated in recent years. In 1859, Baptists in the United States controlled 24 colleges and 10 departments or institutions for theological instruction. Today, within the Southern Baptist Convention alone, there are 52 colleges owned by the denomination. Not only are there more Baptist schools, but in recent years, there has been a distinct re-emphasis within our Baptist colleges on ministerial education. The leading article in the January 1952 issue of the Southern Baptist Educator claims for the colleges the responsibility outlined by Dr. Boyce in 1856 for the seminary he proposed, insofar as the seminary was to provide for the preparation of the minister who, for any reason, was unable to take the full course of training, including both college and seminary work. Several Baptist colleges have enlarged their departments of religion and designed their curriculum to provide not only a major in religion through the Bachelor of Arts degree, but also a Master of Arts degree in religion. For some of you who perchance are not Baptist, that is not entirely new, but there is an entirely new emphasis within our Baptist colleges at that point. I rejoice in the strengthening of the Bible department in every Baptist college. I would only observe the obvious caution that the colleges should lead no student to believe that he has completed his theological education upon receiving either the Bachelor of Arts or Master of Arts degree. The curriculum of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary is based upon the broad general education provided by the colleges and goes far beyond the specialized religious courses which neither time available nor number of faculty members in a college can provide. It is still true that a shortcut education to the ministry means the effectiveness of a ministry cut short. The point which is here to be underscored is that the seminary is no longer alone under the responsibility for the training of ministers of limited educational opportunity. That responsibility is now shared by the colleges in new and stronger fashion. This does not mean that the day has come when men without a college degree will be automatically refused admission to the seminary. It does mean, however, that all such men who desire ministerial education may be urged to attend a college and urged that they seek entrance to the seminary only when there is no alternative. Southern Baptist Theological Seminary will continue to consider its responsibility to include all Southern Baptists who should be trained for the ministry. To that end, it now participates, for example, in the seminary extension service and will, should the colleges retire from the field, liberalize its admission standards anew. Today, however, the demand for theological education on the part of men who have completed their college work is so great as to tax the resources of the three older Southern Baptist seminaries beyond endurance. The denomination has therefore created two new seminaries, one at Berkeley, California, and the other at Wake Forest, North Carolina, while at the same time moving the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary to a more spacious campus. It is anticipated that these provisions will mean that a larger proportion of Baptist ministers will receive seminary training. At least for myself, it is hoped that it will also mean a reduced enrollment here. The greatness of a seminary is not measured by its size, but by the quality of its instruction. That is a two-edged sword. On one hand, it means that there is no advantage in striving to be big. On the other hand, it means that being small does not guarantee greatness. It is axiomatic that a student-faculty ratio, which requires a professor to spread his interest over too many students, reduces instructional effectiveness. It is equally true that a faculty so small as to require a professor to spread his interest over too many subjects interferes with instructional effectiveness. Southern Baptist Theological Seminary began with four faculty members when that was about the maximum throughout the land in any seminary. Today there are 23 faculty members, each a specialist within a given field, each with time to concentrate upon the preparation of the courses for which he is responsible. This takes no account of 7 instructors and 30 fellows who are also part of the instructional staff. We do recognize, however, that despite the advantage of specialization within the faculty, the ideal student-faculty ratio requires either more faculty members or fewer students. Budgetary limitations determine the number of faculty members. That's why I was interested in those Georgia Railroad bonds a few moments ago. Unless additional generous donors can be found, the only practical solution is some limitation upon the number of students. We do not intend to deny seminary education to any man who is qualified for it, but we do expect to share the load with the 4 other denominational seminaries. I would propose as an immediate goal a reduction of the student body to not more than 750 ministerial students. Instead of an arbitrary limitation on the number of students to be admitted each year, I propose that the requirements of the curriculum shall be increased to the point that no more than 750 students will be willing to undertake the courses. There is no novelty in that suggestion. The students will tell you that that procedure has already been inaugurated so far as the graduate school is concerned. Fortunately, I do not have to take the graduate school entrance examinations now required of the students. The danger at this point is that the academic requirements will be raised with a view to producing research scholars instead of pastors. The students of this seminary must be trained primarily for the pastoral ministry. This must be the basic purpose of the Bachelor of Divinity curriculum. The development of research scholars can safely be reserved for the graduate Master of Theology and Doctor of Theology courses. The second function of the seminary, that of providing leadership for the denomination, will be carried out through the development of both students and faculty. Provision of the best instruction for students who are willing to undertake the most difficult of courses will guarantee the graduation of men who have the qualities of leadership. This process has worked through the years, as evidenced by the large proportion of Southern Seminary alumni in places of denominational leadership today. I might pause to comment with some pride that four of the five presidents of the five Baptist seminaries in the South today are alumni of this school. Our goal also is to have every member of the faculty recognized throughout the denomination as the authority in his field. To achieve that goal, the seminary must provide each faculty member with adequate income to free his mind from worry and his time from the necessity of rendering service for pay outside of the seminary. He must have adequate library facilities and a teaching load adjusted to provide time for research and for study, both here and elsewhere. Additional colleagues must share the student load and make possible the concentration of major effort within given fields of study. With a young, though not inexperienced, faculty, an emphasis at this point will provide rich returns in the years immediately ahead. The democratic polity of the Baptist denomination rests upon the conviction that the composite mind of the entire constituency is likely to be right more often than the mind of any single organization or individual. The possibility of error, however, creates the necessity for the third function of the seminary, the re-examination of denominational life in the light of the Word of God. The danger in democratic polity is that in lieu of selected leadership, we shall have self-appointed leaders, and that instead of a responsible body to whom authority is delegated, we shall have a group which seizes control of authority, which supposedly resides in the entire constituency. The checks and balances of our federal government were established by our forefathers to forestall such deterioration in our nation's democratic political life. The same principle of checks and balances is needed in the life of a democratic denomination. The seminary will find its place not in the administrative nor the legislative functions, but rather within the judicial framework. The force of its judgment is contained in no legal authority, but rather in the amount of true light which it may shed. The seminary must ever be free to focus the light of its knowledge upon the plans and policies and decisions of the denomination. There will always be those who will attempt to maintain their position and support their cause by capturing the seminary as an instrument of propaganda and as a rubber stamp for their own judgments. The danger that the majority decision of the denomination may be manipulated by a small group is accompanied by the danger that the actual majority may be wrong. To refuse to reckon with the latter possibility is to assume not only that Southern Baptists have already received all the truth, but also that no circumstances could ever condition their application of it. For example, history and the slavery issue teach us differently. The poet wrote, "New occasions teach new duties. Time makes ancient good uncouth." Jesus, too, took account of the shifting historical scene, but he set his word as more permanent than the North Star to guide us. Said he, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away." He spoke truth, eternal truth, that should stand the test of time. He launched that truth in human experience. In his words, he spoke them not in the ordered procession of a philosopher, but released them at random, wherever someone in need would give them ear. He sought no auspicious setting for profound pronouncements, rather an audience of one worthless woman and the curbstone of a well provided the occasion for a discourse which the marching feet of time can never drown out. His words belong not to his day, but to all the tomorrows. Yet he wrote them in no book, but sowed them in the lives of those who would listen. Careless did he seem with the truth he spoke, for he sought to perpetuate it in no school or political organization. He simply bade his friends pass on his words. Now his words are echoed in the language of all the earth. They have become the breath of hope to many millions. They have become the guide of life to many who are perplexed. Comfort have they been to the sorrowing. Courage have they brought to those in fear. They have enchanted us and changed us. For whenever and wherever they are repeated, these words of Jesus lead men through faith to identify themselves with him who is the way, the truth, and the life. His words are old with the passing centuries, but they leap from their setting to become as fresh as reflected sunlight on the dew of the morning, for they speak the way of redemption. They are the language of faith by which the death and resurrection of Christ are mediated as the personal possession of all who would have life abundant and eternal. The words of God need no editing by the minds of men. The truths of God need no retouching by the hands of men. They need only to be set to the music of our hearts rejoicing that God so loved us and loves us now. It is the task of a seminary not to say what God should have said or what God would say, but simply what God has said. To chip away the barnacles which accumulate about what God did say. That is not so easy as we naively suppose. It is not just a matter of securing an accurate text of the Bible in the original tongue. The barnacles do not accumulate so much on the record of the divine revelation as they accumulate in the minds of the readers. The process is so gradual that unconsciously men begin to read tradition into the Word of God and to use the Word of God as proof text for the products of an extra-Christian rationalism. Both ancient and modern history are replete with illustrations of Christian groups convincing themselves that God must want what human pride and logic demand. Always the appeal is to the Word of God for authority. And thus the Word of God is made the occasion and justification for diverse and contradictory practices, not only between denominations, but even within the history of one denomination. It is the privilege of a seminary to devote itself to inquiring what God has said without reference to the expediences of the moment. The seminary can claim no infallibility, but it can achieve an objectivity which will make its interpretation worth a hearing by all who seek to do the will of God. The Southern Baptist Theological Seminary belongs to the denomination. Above that, it belongs to the truth all the truth, but especially to the revelation of God, we commit ourselves without reservation to proclaiming and to preparing men to proclaim the Word of God.